From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two bodybuilders who are now in their 80s reminisce about the 1940s when they were among the stars of Muscle Beach in Santa Monica. We'll talk to Pudgy and Les Stockton. Pudgy is a pioneer of women's bodybuilding and was known as the Queen of Muscle Beach. She's one of the people included in the new book, Picturing the Modern Amazon, about hypermuscular and physically strong women. Also, the story of Chess Records, the Chicago-based label that recorded blues and rhythm and blues greats such as Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf, Chuck Berry, and Eddie James. We'll talk with Nadine Cahotas, author of Spinning Blues into Gold, a history of the label and the two brothers who created it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Accusing Democrats of engaging in partisan politics, Senate Republicans have rejected a patient's bill of rights backed by the Clinton administration. The measure would have given consumers new rights to sue their health maintenance organizations if they're denied care. Opponents, such as Senator Don Nichols, the GOP whip, said the measure would deprive more Americans of health insurance because it would drive up the cost for businesses that offer coverage to their employees. Supporters, such as Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle, said the bill would help thousands of Americans get the health care they need. The nation's leading automobile companies say they'll make same-sex partners of employees in the United States eligible for health care benefits. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
When General Motors, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler agreed to new labor contracts last year with the United Auto Workers Union, the agreements included a commitment to study the possibility of providing benefits to same-sex domestic partners. Now all three say they will extend benefits to partners of employees as a way of demonstrating their commitment to encouraging diversity in the workplace. The companies also acknowledge that their action is in keeping with competitive trends among Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. Workers seeking such benefits will be required to attest that they and their domestic partner are of the same sex and that they have shared a committed relationship for a period of at least 6 months. Combined, the three automakers employ nearly a 500,000 workers in the U.S. It's expected that about 1% would ask for benefits for their partners under the new program. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
Virgin Atlantic Airlines says it wants to be the first to use Boeing's new stretch jumbo jet, the 747X, and also has bid for a new giant model from European rival Airbus. Virgin says it believes the new planes will revolutionize flying. Alistair Wanklin reports from London.
Super jumbo jets would have bedrooms, showers, and even stand-up bars, according to Virgin Atlantic boss Richard Branson, who wants his firm to be the first to use the planned Boeing 747X and among the first to fly the Airbus A3XX. Currently, both models exist only on paper, and Airbus hasn't announced whether it'll go ahead and build its planned giant, but Virgin expects to receive the planes in about 5 years' time when it'll need to replace many of its existing jumbo jets. Branson said with airport slots getting rarer and with more people wanting to fly, these giant planes make sense and should also be cheaper to run on Virgin's long-haul routes. For NPR News, I'm Alistair Wanklin in London.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 143 points, or 1.3%, to close at 10,670 in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 14 points to close at 3,826. This is NPR News. Police in Los Angeles say they've arrested a suspect in the murder of the police chief's granddaughter. The suspect was identified as 18-year-old Samuel Shabazz Jr. He's being investigated in connection with the shooting of Lori Gonzalez, the 20-year-old granddaughter of police chief Bernard Parks. Gonzalez was killed last month in what police say was a gang-related shooting. The gunman was reportedly aiming at the passenger in her car. A federal grand jury in Mississippi has indicted a 69-year-old white man in the civil rights-era murder of a black farm worker. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Ernest A. Vance faces a single count of murder in the 1966 slaying of elderly farmhand Ben Chester White near Natchez. Avance was acquitted of the crime in a Mississippi court 33 years ago, but federal prosecutors took jurisdiction in the case recently after learning that the murder took place on federal property, a national forest. That allowed the government to pursue the case without violating double jeopardy provisions that prohibit retrial on the same charges. Avance was indicted with a rarely used federal murder charge. U.S. Attorney Brad Pigott says no time is too late to vindicate the country's interest in repudiating the kind of violence Avance is accused of. Two other suspects have since died. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The Census Bureau says it now has 97% of American homes counted. Bureau Director Kenneth Pruitt says the census will step up its efforts to count the remaining 3.1 million homes by early July. Most of the uncounted cases are in major cities, including the urban poor and wealthier people in communities that are protective of their privacy. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before bodybuilding became a national craze for men and women, Santa Monica's Muscle Beach was an arena for weightlifters to show off their muscles and perform feats of strength and extraordinary stunts. Muscle Beach has been called the birthplace of the physical fitness boom of the 20th century. My guests, Pudgy and Les Stockton, were two of the stars of Muscle Beach in the late 30s and the 40s. Pudgy is a pioneer of women's bodybuilding and was nicknamed the Queen of Muscle Beach. Pudgy, Les, and their friends often teamed up to form human pyramids and human towers, which required supporting men who were balanced on top of Les and Pudgy's shoulders or torsos. Les and Pudgy married in 1941 and later in the decade opened several gyms. They're now in their 80s and live in Southern California. Pudgy is one of the women profiled in the new book, Picturing the Modern Amazon, about hypermuscular and physically strong women. It's a companion book to the exhibit of the same name, currently at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. I asked Pudgy Stockton why she first decided to take up bodybuilding.
Well, I wanted to reduce. After I graduated from high school, I went from 112 pounds up to 130, a little bit more than that probably. I guess about 135. And so Les was my boyfriend then, and he brought me down some weights, and they were mostly adjustable dumbbells. And so a lot of the things that I did from the course that he brought were mostly upper body exercises. So then I got interested in doing more exercise of some other kinds. So I went to the library and found some books, a few. There weren't very many. And I also found Bernard McFadden's magazines, which had some exercise in it. And so I started doing those, and then at home even I worked out. I was learning to do a headstand, which to me was not as much fun as doing handstands, but it led up to the handstands in a sense.
Okay, Terry, the thing you have to remember that this is 60 years ago. Now, bodybuilding wasn't even a word.
Right.
And it was so new that we obviously didn't know that we're beginning something that was going to open up to something as great as it did. Well, so that's why Pudge had the title, of course, the first American female bodybuilder.
Well, Les Stockton, Pudgy said that you were the one who first brought her weights. Were you already doing bodybuilding yourself?
Not too long. I worked out with her brother. We found out that somebody had gained 20 pounds, a center on the football team, and I asked this gentleman who was with us he said, "Well, would you like to gain weight like that? Or would you like to gain some weight like that?" In fact, I was a lifeguard at the Del Mar Club, and he had the locker room. And so he says, "Well," he said, "I got a lot of weights," he says, "and the magazines and things, and you work out in our basement." So I worked out with Pudge's brother. Can you imagine that? First, And then a couple months later, Pudge came along and changed our whole life.
Pudge, I've seen some pictures of you from the 1940s, and you had very visible, well-developed muscles on your arms, your chest. Had you ever seen other women with muscles like that?
No, not anybody in, you know, that I knew personally, but at that time I had, of course, gone to circus and had seen some of the women that worked in the circuses, and that probably was the only place that that I ever saw anybody like that at that time. It wasn't like it became later.
Were you ever worried that people would find it masculine for a woman like you to have muscles?
Well, there were those who felt that way. That's true. And, of course, in working out that way, I never felt masculine. I never had a desire to be a man or any of that sort of thing. But occasionally there'd be some people that would make remarks.
Like what?
Offhand. Well, one time when I was up in Hollywood, we had there was a big area there, in a building that we used to do practice some of our things in the winter time, and I was working out with a two-piece suit, and as I went across the floor to go back and get into my regular clothes, and I heard these people that I just passed. This girl says, "Oh, she looks just like a man from the back." Well, I didn't particularly like that, but
Terry, she was 36, 22, 34. She certainly didn't look like a man from the front.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because judging from pictures, Pudgy Stockton, you have a large bust.
Yes, I do.
And was that a good thing for you? Because it certainly helped define you as female, no matter how many big muscles you were carrying. You know, you were very, very female. So was that a good thing? Or if you don't mind me asking this, did a large bust ever get in the way of the kind of exercise that
no.
you wanted to do, or the kind no. of stunts that you wanted to
no.
do?
No, that never was. Never ever had gave me any problems.
Mm-hmm.
No, not at all.
So, do you ever worry that men wouldn't find you attractive because you were so muscular?
Well, no, I never felt that way, because most all the people that we had close contact with were all in favor of all these things we were doing. And
right.
so it was, we didn't have that feeling. There was always a few people that would stand around and, I suppose, make remarks, but I never paid much attention to that.
Let me ask your husband here. Les Stockton, what was it like for you when your wife started getting bigger and bigger muscles? She wasn't your wife yet, but she was your girlfriend.
She kept getting stronger, which helped. You know, we didn't have to worry as much about some of the tricks and things that we were doing, that we were right on borderlines, and we needed every advantage we could get. On this Muscle Beach gossip column here in Muscle Mag, he said, Pudge had it all, a body muscularly developed yet incredibly voluptuous, and skill as a world-class hand balancer and acrobat, and strength enough to lift nearly her own weight overhead. She could support more than twice her weight overhead as an understander in a human pyramid and so forth. And I think the added strength was so much a plus that the muscle didn't stick out there like a cantaloupe or anything like that. She was never too happy about doing a bicep flexed pose, because that wasn't her area at all. She was very modest about those things.
How did strength help you outside of the performances that you did?
Oh, many ways. I felt good. I felt good almost all the time. And I enjoyed, like I say, I had always been an ocean lover, so I always enjoyed swimming, and this helped in my swimming, although I didn't do quite as much after we got to working all the time on these pyramids and tricks, but it seemed to give me a feeling of real I was doing something that I had to work very hard to learn, and it was something that when I looked back on my high school time, there was some of the exercises that we had to do there that I didn't like to do at all, and now I had completely changed that, and I enjoyed doing the ones that I'd even learned in high school.
Most of the pictures I've seen of you, Pudgy, you're wearing a two-piece bathing suit.
Yes.
Is that usually what you wore for performances?
At first, of course, two-piece bathing suits were not very prevalent in those days, not at the start. And so I had to wear a one-piece, but it was not easy to wear when we were doing the kind of tricks we were doing. So my mother made me bras to wear with... Actually, I had to wear men's swimming trunks, yes. And so she would take and make a pattern from bras, and then I would tie them around my neck, and they'd go across my back. And that was much more comfortable, especially when I had to lie on my back to do some of the tricks, and that way I didn't have anything that sticks into your you know, it make you uncomfortable.
We had Janie at the beach. She was a custom swimsuit maker and suit maker, and she made all of her custom two-piece suits for Pudge, and she was a terrific ad because these gals really truck right down there to get the same type of suit, you know. So she started kind of a trend in that area.
Yes, that was because it took a while before two-piece suits became popular, and it was more or less towards the end of maybe just around the time the war started that it was becoming a more seen type of bathing suit.
Acceptable.
My guests are Les and Pudgy Stockton, two of the bodybuilders who were stars of Muscle Beach in the 1940s. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Pudgy Stockton and Les Stockton. They were two of the stars of Muscle Beach in the 40s. What would you describe what Muscle Beach was like at its peak?
It was a place that always drew people standing around watching. This was one of the things about it that always happened. And, of course, on holidays... usually on the weekends, particularly on Sunday, we'd have vast numbers of people around us. But it wasn't so much that we were showing off as we were enjoying what we were doing, so that it was a very wonderful pastime for all of us. Eventually, of course, some of the various couples, including my husband and I, did regular acts that they went out and did shows and that sort of thing. So that, and another thing too, we often had people in the town who were at circuses and stage acts.
Professional acts.
Yes, professional acts. And they would come down, and if they wanted to work with us, this was great. And they taught us lots of things, and I think they maybe learned a few tricks, too, from us.
May I ask how old each of you are?
Yes. I'll be 83 in August, and Les will be 84 in October.
I'm 83 and a half.
And do you work out at all anymore?
I still do some exercises with some weights that I keep under my bed. And for a very long time, we had gotten into climbing stairs. There's a group of very high stairs, maybe 180 to 200 stairs, and we used to go there a great deal. And when I had to stop running, I was glad that I could still do the stairs because it was it was something I enjoyed doing. We don't do as much as we used to do, of course.
We do our 2 to 3 mile walks.
Yes, yeah, so we do a lot of walking. But of course, we had gone into hiking. We joined the Sierra Club after we were out of the gym business.
Now, what has happened to your muscles with age? What do they look like? How
well, yeah. You're not as firm if you don't, you know, if you sit around very much, you're certainly not
as
firm
sorry.
As you were.
My rule, Terry, is when you got it, you flaunt it. When you don't have it, you cover it up.
Are you in the covering up stage?
Certainly are. no, it's not too bad. She still is right down about 1816, so... We haven't changed that much.
You said that when you started bodybuilding, there wasn't even a word called bodybuilding yet.
And I don't think so. Mm-mm.
And bodybuilding has become such a craze.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you think of bodybuilding now and what the image of, you know, the perfect body has become.
Well, of course, the men in the bodybuilding have become much larger than any of the people that we knew in the early days, except possibly John Grimmick was always considered the ideal physique at that time. Of course, with the women, it was a different thing because it hadn't gone into the muscular development that they now are using. That didn't happen in those days. There was not much of anything like that at that time. That all started in more into this late 60s and the early 70s and on beyond.
What they're going through right now as far as the professional bodybuilders and things are concerned is that we're back into a natural bodybuilding. Now, the steroids, of course, have been frowned upon, even though it made these guys so huge you can't possibly imagine anybody getting to that size, and it's been wonderful if you like the large muscles, of course. And we just received this a few weeks ago called natural bodybuilding, and now natural bodybuilding means bodybuilding without the use of chemical steroids implicitly.
Well, do you agree that steroids have kind of perverted our idea of what a great body looks like?
Oh, gosh, no. Steroids are absolutely essential to these huge muscle types. Pudge and I really don't agree on this subject here very much. Because I said when I weighed, 145 pounds and I was building my weight up to 185, boy, if those steroids had been there, I'd have grabbed them right away and done it. East Germany was winning all the Olympic events, and America find out what they were doing, that they were using steroids and things, and they jumped on them, and then they went into drug testing and everything else to stop this sort of thing. But you can't discount the fact that this is a way to get these huge, huge muscles, and if this is what you want, the biggest oranges in the orchard, you would use the chemicals.
Pudgy, during the 1940s, you were considered the queen of Muscle Beach. What kind of publicity did you get? What kind of photographs were shot of you?
Oh, there were people down there all the time with cameras. And, of course, some of them were very generous, and they would send me pictures in the mail and this sort of thing, or bring them down to me and so forth. So I have quite a collection. And many of them are almost just candid shots, though. But... in addition to this, we also had a wonderful photographer that worked with us when we wanted special pictures, and he did most of that.
She's kind of modest about this. When she started getting that body, you know, the media were attracted, and they were constantly down there. Where's Pudgy Stockton? And of course, she was on the cover of Life and all these other different magazines. And she's got 29 albums full of the stuff, paper clippings, and she faces out and things. And actually, it was quite flattering, but it was kind of interfering, too, because you wanted to do your workouts and they wanted pictures.
Right. Would you leave us with a favorite memory of Muscle Beach?
Favorite memory of Muscle Beach? Well, it seems like it was always sunny. Of course, it wasn't, but it always seemed like it was always sunny. And there was always people there that you felt very close to. And it was just a wonderful experience. That's the only way I can express it. It was just something that was different in your life and it had become our life. And it was a wonderful experience to learn all those things and be capable of doing them. And it's something that we'll never forget.
And it recurs, Terry. We just were at a Venice Beach award to one of our Muscle Beach members, which they hand out each year. Pudge got it 5 years ago. And we get to see our people over and over again. And this is a wonderful,
well,
a wonderful feeling.
We have an association, Muscle Beach Association, also, but some of the people had joined, and many of them didn't join. But it's always brought them together, and so we try to get a hold of as many people as we can and get together, and we go out to dinner, and it's like no other group in my life. It seems like we're always close to these people.
Well, it sounds
Whitey,
like,
Whitey Sunby, who is our chronicler, he calls it a Camelot, a paradise, a home, a family. That's about it.
Yes, that's very true.
That's what we remember.
Lesson Pudgy Stockton talking about Muscle Beach. Pudgy Stockton is one of the women profiled in the new book, Picturing the Modern Amazon, about physically strong and hypermuscular women. It's a companion to the exhibit of the same name, which is now at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. And from Random House, Inc.'s Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Protecting the Gift, A Parent's Guide to Keeping Children and Teenagers Safe by Gavin DeBecker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how two Polish Jewish immigrants came to create a legendary blues label. We talk with Nadine Kohotas about Chess Records, which recorded blues and rhythm and blues greats such as Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Bo Diddley, Willie Dixon, and Etta James. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Helen Wolf, Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, Bo Diddley, Eddie James, Little Walter are just some of the blues and rhythm and blues stars who recorded for Chess Records. Chess was based in Chicago and played a prominent role in recording the new urban and electrified blues of the 1950s. These records were particularly influential to British blues aficionados like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Cream, and Led Zeppelin. These bands covered and wrote songs inspired by the Chess recordings, and that led many young American listeners to discover the older blues performers who were part of the roots of rock and roll. Chess also recorded one of the first great rock and roll records by Chuck Berry.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out run my vehicle. A Cadillac doing about 95, moves bumper to bumper, rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true?
That song was recorded and named by Leonard Chess, who owned Chess Records with his brother Phil. My guest Nadine Cahotas has written a new book called Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. It tells the story of how two Polish-Jewish immigrants moved to Chicago and created a legacy of great blues recordings. The brothers sold the label in 1969. Leonard died soon after. Phil is retired. Their son Marshall runs their music publishing company. I asked Cahotas about the Chess family after it came to Chicago in 1928, when Leonard and Phil were boys.
It was a scrappy kind of existence. Their father was very determined, and he opened a junk shop, as did many other immigrants from Eastern Europe. There were something like 40, 50, 60 junk shop listings in the Yellow Pages in Chicago in the time we're talking about, the late 30s and 40s. So they got used to being in that community and were making some kind of living. And Leonard had never really wanted to be in the junk business at all. And he found an opportunity to open his first liquor store in the heart of the Black Belt at 5060 South State Street. So in my own mind, I've attributed it to circumstance plus determination and the instinct for an opportunity.
So from liquor stores, the Chess Brothers moved into a club, the Macomba, and then got into records. First, Leonard Chess became a partner in Aristocrat Records, and then when his partner in that company left, Leonard's brother Philip got involved with the company, and then they changed the name to Chess Records.
Yes, that's right. I just was going to say one thing. It's really rather a delicious story about how Leonard got into Aristocrat Records, in that the founding of Aristocrat, a remarkable woman in her 20s, a woman named Evelyn Aaron, who had the moxie to decide to go into the record business, raised some of her own money with a couple of friends and put out a few records. And because of the small community of people doing a certain kind of music on the south side of Chicago, Leonard knew who she was and vice versa, and he decided to take a chance and try to record someone who was singing in his club. And I just found that most fascinating. There were not very many women back then who were in the record business at all.
You say that it was Muddy Waters who made Leonard Chess see a possible future in music. How did they meet?
They met when Muddy was asked to come and do a session through his friend Sunnyland Slim, who was a piano player. And Leonard almost missed the boat, if I can use that term, in the first instance, when he heard him singing his very, very haunting and now a famous "I Can't Be Satisfied" and "I Feel Like Going Home." He really couldn't understand what Muddy was saying, and he said, "What's he saying? What's he saying?" He could not really see that there might be a market for that, because it was quite different from the music that he had been hearing in his own club, which was jump blues with saxophone players and different kind of bass being played and different kind of piano. This was something different. So that is how they met.
Why don't we hear "I Can't Be Satisfied," Muddy Waters, okay. 1948 recording.
Ah! right down south, child, don't you worry. Oh, woman, I'm trouble. I be all good now. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep up. Well, I feel like snapping pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some great God, Lord, be her resting place. Woman, I'm trouble. I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on.
That's Muddy Waters on electric guitar and vocals. He also wrote the song, I Can't Be Satisfied, recorded for Leonard Chess in 1948. I think part of the story of Chess Records is what it was like to sell records if you were making rhythm and blues or blues records in the late 40s and the 1950s. Leonard Chess was really very good at selling records. First of all, what was he up against selling rhythm and blues records or blues records, what was known then as race records? What was the differences between selling that and selling recordings by white performers?
I think one of the obvious answers is a much smaller market, because you have a much smaller potential to read that market. There was very little radio play for race records, for black music, when the Chess Brothers and the other independent record labels like King and Savoy and Modern out in California got started. The bulk of their trade was really jukeboxes in taverns and shops and that sort of thing. You simply had to get out on the road thousands of miles, days and days and days, with your car full of records to drop off to every distributor, every disc jockey, to try to see if you could interest them in playing the music. It was difficult, but out of that came what I came to believe was kind of like a fraternity of people who knew one another. They would run into one another on the road. There's one moment, for example, where another record producer named Leah Gelnick ran into Leonard. They had the same itinerary, so they traveled together. They were plenty competitive and cutthroat in a certain way, but yet there was this sense of a shared mission.
What would Leonard Chess do to sweeten it for DJs, to inspire DJs to play his records?
I think the sweetening came in a couple of forms. First of all, there was giving them the free records to play, and then what people used to talk about as the $50 handshake. It may not always have been $50. It may have been the $10 or the $25 handshake. And, of course, we came later to know of it as payola. The other thing was sometimes giving a writing credit to a disc jockey as a way of securing some future money if the record took off, which they would have a hand in helping make happen. Then as a writer, that individual would be entitled to some publishing royalties. One of the difficult things to sort out in working on this was how those transactions actually worked on the ground. Leonard is not here to talk to us about it, but when I talked to Phil about sometimes seeing a writing credit, his memory was that sometimes that was done with consent. I use that term in the broad sense. That is to say, look, we'll give you $100 right now, and this guy's name is going to go on the record, and everybody's betting against the future. It's very difficult if you weren't in the same room. One of the things I think that is not contestable is that these were very rarely meetings between peers. You're an artist, you're struggling, you want to get a record out. Here's the producer who's going to put the record on the label for you. You don't really have a terrific bargaining position. You're in there, they say, look, we got to do it right now or we're not going to do it. And you say, okay, I'll take the $100. the guy's name goes on the record. Later, if it becomes a million seller, you have to share those royalties.
My guest is Nadine Cahotas, author of a new book about the blues and rhythm and blues label Chess Records. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nadine Cahotas. She's the author of the new book, Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. Let's talk a little bit about Willie Dixon and his importance to Chess Records. He was a bass player, a songwriter. He arranged and produced a lot of the sessions at Chess. Some of the songs he wrote include Backdoor Man and Little Red Rooster, which the Rolling Stones covered, Spoonful, which Cream covered, You Shook Me, which Led Zeppelin did, and You Need Love, which Led Zeppelin borrowed heavily from for their song Whole Lotta Love. Tell us a little bit more about Willie Dixon and his place at Chess.
Well, as you said, he produced a lot of sessions. He found talent. He just knew everybody and knew everybody you needed to know to put a session together. And when there was time to go into the recording session, if you couldn't find a musician, Willie Dixon could find that musician and get him into the studio and get things going. Leonard and Phil were not musicians, but they had terrific business instincts, and I think a part of that was knowing what they knew, knowing what they didn't know, and who could help them provide it. So Willie Dixon, in my mind, was one of several people who filled in the large musical gaps of Leonard and Phil in trying to build this company.
Let's hear Helen Wolfe singing Spoonful, a song written by Willie Dixon. Willie Dixon is featured on bass. As you point out, Chess Records developed the image of being like a sharecropping system. What did they do to get that image?
I think that what I meant to suggest there, not so much that they were sharecropping, but I guess that it could look like sharecropping. They took care of the musicians, the artists, almost like family. And in one interview that I was able to hear that Phil gave, that was closer to the time of Chess being in existence, the interviewer said, "Well, you almost treated them like family, didn't you?" And he said, "Well, yes, that's what they wanted to be treated like. That is to say, say, they bought them cars, they handled their rent, they handled their medical bills, and in several cases provided attorneys when they got into legal scrapes. And as I think I said in the book, one kind of record was made, another was kept.
But like Muddy Waters got an Oldsmobile after the success of Hoochie Coochie Man. Did that come out of his royalties, or was that just a gift?
My understanding was that came out of his royalties. Later on, a woman, one of the women singers in the Chess studio, Mitty Collier, got a Bonneville, and that was that was her choice. She could either have cash or she could have the Bonneville as payment, but it was not a straight-out gift. It was a kind of payment.
Now, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records said to you, "We didn't make our artists' car payments. We didn't pay their mortgages. We didn't dress them. We were not lords of the manor." Do you think that a lot of people in the record industry felt that it wasn't a good system that the Chess Brothers were using to pay their artists, that it was patronizing?
I think that's certainly accurate, that that a lot of people felt that. I think that it was an evolution that came from both sides. I think we have to remember that the musicians would come in asking for something and needing to be taken care of, and Leonard and Phil met those needs. From their perspective, they didn't think they were running a charitable institution, and felt that, yes, you're in trouble, we're going to take care of you. We have mutual self-interest here. If you're not available, you can't make a record. You can't make a record. We can't make money. I'm happy to help you, but this is like an advance, and so I am going to note this. One of the issues here is the method of record keeping. You know, how much was advanced, and in what form it was advanced, and was that an appropriate amount of money that was set down? And then alternatively, how many records were sold, and how quickly am I getting up to date? So little documentation, and I think it was unfair to just have the allegations without trying to understand in a larger sense what was going on. If I could just continue here, the one place where I was able to see clearly in black and white on a meticulously kept ledger sheet was a little label in Jackson, Mississippi, Trumpet Records, that was the first home of Sonny Boy Williamson. The late Lillian McMurray kept precise records of every record that was sold, and every time Sonny Boy or the other people who recorded for her came in and asked for a loan. And I believe something like 60 times in the space of a year, Sonny Boy came in and said, "I need money for this. I got to get my instrument out of hock. I have to get the chairs taken care of." There's a poignant letter from Sonny Boy's wife to Mrs. McMurray. "Can you please send Sonny Boy's money to me? Because otherwise, if you don't, I'm not going to get it." And I say this again just to try to give a flavor of the context back then of these relationships between musician and label owner. It was much, indeed, more familial than I think we might realize, but it did have aspects of sharecropping in that one person kept the books.
You know, the things that you're describing in a way feed into that image that is very popular in aspects of music lore. The image I'm speaking of is that, you know, African-American artists make great recordings while the Jews who owned many of the record labels and clubs exploited them. And there's this, like, black-Jew conflict in a lot of music lore. And I'm wondering how you think the Chess Brothers story fits into that lore, and what you, trying to be fair and objective about that, have to say about it.
Right. Well, it certainly fits into that lore very, very much so. And I came away from this book feeling that it was not that at all, that there were rich and important relationships between many of the artists and Leonard and Phil Chess. One of the special moments to me was Marshall's bar mitzvah, which was April 17th, 1955, when he turned 13 years old. And I suppose everybody knows what a bar mitzvah is when, in the Jewish tradition, you reach the age of being an adult in the eyes of the community. And I say the date again, April 17th, 1955. This is a year, less than a year after the Brown v. Board of Education decision from the Supreme Court, which decreed that that segregated schools were per se unconstitutional. And Marshall's Bar Mitzvah was a fully integrated social event, both the service and then a big dinner for everybody at the Morrison Hotel. And I made sure to include a couple of tables as part of the pictures in the book that show the Chess family's cleaning lady and her husband sitting at a table with other Chess relatives. Another table was Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler from Atlantic, along with a black DJ and his wife. And I found, having done some work previous to this on civil rights issues and Southern political history, this was quite remarkable to me to have a socially integrated dinner in Chicago in April 1955, knowing that there would not have been such a dinner in Jackson, Mississippi, in Mobile, Alabama, in Birmingham. The other thing, when I had a chance to talk with some of the musicians who are still alive, particularly Etta James, both in her own autobiography, and then when we were talking, there is a deep affection that came through to me in talking to these people. Ahmet Jamal, when he said to me, you know, it was like a good marriage. They were good to me. I was good to them. When Muddy Waters gave an interview to the Louisville Defender in, I believe, 1952 or 1953, and he spoke about how important his friendship was with Leonard Chess. So I came away from all of this feeling that the lore was somewhat misplaced, and that these were far more complicated and important relationships going both ways.
My guest is Nadine Kohoutis, author of a new book about the blues and rhythm and blues label Chess Records. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nadine Kohoutis, author of Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. There's a story that Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones told that I think added to the legends of the Chess Brothers as exploiting the artists who recorded for them. Why don't you tell what the story was about Muddy Waters?
Yes, the story was that when the Rolling Stones were making one of their visits to the famed studio at 2120 South Michigan Avenue, they walked in and saw somebody up on a ladder painting, and one of them said, "Who's that?" And they said, "Oh, that's Muddy Waters." I do not believe that that story is at all true. People who were working there every day, black musicians and producers and white producers and other people, never, ever, ever saw Muddy Waters doing anything like that, nor would Leonard have ever permitted that. Several people said, starting with Marshall, you can discount Marshall if you want, and talk about Billy Davis, who was so critical to the operation. Muddy Waters was terribly important to Chess and a deeply important person to Leonard personally. I don't believe it to be true, but it is a wonderful story and has great political heft and deep, deep lore.
How often did you hear the story that they made Muddy Waters paint the ceiling, and there he was and in his overalls on a ladder when the Rolling Stones came in? Did you hear that from a lot of sources? I mean, had the story just kind of like developed legs?
Oh, certainly. Certainly it's in articles about the company. It was in one new book, relatively new book, about Muddy Waters, and it's part of the gossip, part of the chatter, part of the background noise about Chess. One of the first things I heard, others were that he tended bar, that he cut grass, and none of those things was the case.
What's the status of most of the Chess recordings now? Most of them, many of the great ones, have been reissued. Who owns those masters now?
Yes, MCA Universal, if I have that right, MCA is a part of Universal. They own the Chess catalog, and over the last several years, largely due to one of the creative and interested A&R men, that is, interested in this genre of music, Andy McKay, there have been many, many reissues that have served to keep the music alive. Compilations, box sets of the major artists, theme ones like the Soul Years and Rhythm and Roll. So that is where the music is. Arc Music, which is run by Marshall Chess, still owns a great number of the copyrights. That's a separate issue. But the actual session tapes, and there are something like 8,000 of them, reside in this remarkable building in California, which is all of what the Universal Corporation owns, all the other music companies, and there they are. And I think we have to be appreciative that so many were saved and that they have been reissued so that we can keep listening to them.
Nadine Cahotas is the author of Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
I walk 47 miles of barbed wire. I use a cobra snake for a necktie. I got a brand new house on the roadside, made from rattlesnake hide. I got a brand new chimney made on top, made out of a human skull. Now come on, take a little walk with me, Arlene, and tell me, who do you love? 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 Tombstone hand and a graveyard mind, just 22 and I don't mind dying. Who do you love? Who do you love? Who do you love?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Dennis Hopper, the actor and director, has an exhibit of his photographs from the 60s. Also, actress Mary Woronoff remembers her days in Andy Warhol's factory and Dancing with the Velvet Underground. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.